Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Human Rights, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rin Veith, a host of the channel, and today we'll be talking with Dilek Kurban about her new book, Limits of Supranational Justice, the European Court of Human Rights and Turkey's Kurdish Conflict. Welcome to the show. I was wondering if you could begin by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Thank you for having me. So my name is Dilek Kurban. I am from Turkey, originally born and raised, where I also did my undergraduate. And then I spent several years in the United States doing graduate studies. I studied law in the United States. I did a JD. At Columbia Law School. And then I spent around a decade back in Turkey doing policy-oriented research work as part of this, what we then thought to be the democratization process in Turkey. Subsequently, I've moved to Berlin, where I'm located now, and I transitioned to academia. And the book is the outcome of, it's actually based on my PhD, which I did at Maastricht University Law Department. It was published. I defended my thesis PhD in February 2018 and then turned it into a book, which came out in November 2020. Currently, I'm in Florence as a Max Weber postdoctoral fellow at the European University Institute. And I'm a sociolegal researcher. I'm a human rights lawyer engaged in sociolegal research, and the book is really the product of a couple of things, I would say. I mean, it's based on my observations and the empirical data that I gathered doing field work in Turkey during this phase that I mentioned earlier when I worked at a think tank doing policy work, turn into a PhD, as I said. But it's also, it's also based on my personal observations and experience in Turkey as someone, from that country.
I was wondering if we could start out the conversation about this really amazing book. I feel really lucky that I had the time and the space to really sit with it, because there's a lot going on. But I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the process of sort of how this came to be a little bit more. I find that in some books, sort of the how researchers actually did the work is sort of in the background, but it was really in the fore. And especially you emphasize, the length of time that went into really thinking about this project.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I talk about it in the preface. I tell the story. I think that's what maybe you had in your mind in asking this. And thank you for asking that. So it was in 1998. I was at the time a master's student at Columbia, studying human rights. And I spent several weeks in Turkey's Kurdish region. as a translator and assistant to a fact-finding delegation from the United States. So I was accompanying a group of legal scholars, law students, and lawyers, mainly from Fordham Law School, who were doing fact-finding investigation on independence of judiciary, right to fair trial in Turkey, and also the criminalization of human rights defendants. So that was the first time that I met Kurdish human rights lawyers. I had been to the Kurdish region before. I am Kurdish. I come from a Kurdish immigrant family, but I had never been, first of all, to Diyarbakir, which is really the unofficial, let's say, capital of the Kurdish region. It's the political center. And I had not met Kurdish human rights lawyers before. So two things happened, I think, that ended up being very formative for my own life, and also it resulted in this book. One is I saw that although I was translating their conversations, I saw that Kurdish human rights lawyers and American human rights lawyers were speaking a language that I did not know, the language of law. And it made me understand that I actually had to go to law school to be because at the time I wanted to be a human rights activist and advocate. I was not interested in academic work. And so that was one thing. But more importantly, I was just struck by these lawyers. They were in their early 30s, and they were engaged in human rights work at a time and place which made it very dangerous. The Kurdish region was still governed by state of emergency. They were representing victims of state violence, gross human rights violations, extrajudicial executions, enforced disappearances, torture. These were mostly illiterate, powerless, marginalized Kurdish peasants, but also some middle class as well. So they were representing these victims, but the lawyers themselves were also victims of state violence because of their legal work. So they became, they were arrested, held in incommunicado detention, subject to ill treatment and torture. And none of them spoke English. They had absolutely no access to transnational networks. And I mean, they really were living under gunfire. And yet they were litigating before the European Court of Human Rights and winning precedent-setting judgments. I really was truly, truly, truly impressed. So as I said, I decided to go to law school, which I did. 2 years later, I went back to Colombia and studied law. And at the time, I also decided that I should, engage in ECHR, European Court of Human Rights litigation, which I did not do, but I wrote this book. The story stayed with me for a very, very long time. I mean, over time, over these years, I was in touch with these lawyers. Some of them became my very good friends, who are still very dear friends and colleagues. Along the way, I met new ones. I engaged in all sorts of collaborations. Sometimes we organized advocacy events together. Sometimes I interviewed them as part of my field work. We chatted, for years. We had conversations over dinner, in conference settings, informal, formal. I listened to them. I read their work. The book is not, of course, later I did intensive field work, particularly for the book, but it's just based on these sort of, 98 to, it was published. I mean, I finished writing in 2017, I guess, maybe 15 years or so over than that, of the story, but really my, I went back to Turkey in 2005. So what is it, like 15 years maybe of, thinking, researching about these lawyers. The starting point of the book really I want to tell their story, the story of Kurdish human rights lawyers, especially because over the years I saw how little acknowledged they are in scholarship on the European Court of Human Rights and how little known their stories are. For various reasons, and then when I started doing academic research and looking at literature, I was then struck for the second time by this incredible gap that there was in scholarship on ECHR on Turkey, but also in scholarship on legal mobilization on legal mobilization in authoritarian regimes, including by the Kurdish lawyers. So that's, in a nutshell, the story.
Yeah, I really think that the time that you spent, you know, thinking about these questions, it really, really comes through in the book, because I don't know how you could really wrestle with the scope that you're wrestling with, where you go, you know, you go into the historical past and then really bring us up to the present. It's wonderful. I'm thinking, I know that in some books it can be quite easy to sort of jump through, you know, chapter by chapter. But this book, I loved how there are a lot of interconnecting threads. And so when you were saying just now about Turkish lawyer, or sorry, Kurdish lawyers, I apologize. What you were saying just now about Kurdish lawyers not getting credit for their work, that was something that really struck me in reading this, was that was a theme that kept coming up. And even what you said just before of, you know, lawyers going to the European Court of Human Rights who might not speak the language. And I was wondering if you could, you know, share a little bit about what you saw and how you really see this book as filling that gap. Because in reading this book, I was very convinced of that gap. That was very evident to me.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that. So the book engages in two primary scholarships, and that has to do with my method, in a way. So the question I ask is, well, let me just go back and talk about the empirical gap, right? So, you know, as I start to read the scholar, because the question, you know, the starting one is, of course, I want to tell the story, you know, I want to tell the story of these Kurdish lawyers and how they litigated, what impact they made, etc. But of course, I experienced during this 10 years that I, you know, spent in Turkey, sort of the rise and fall of democratization, and witnessed how yet another reform era in Turkey ended up, you know, sort of collapsed, and that at the end, it remained to be an authoritarian regime. Yet at the same time, this is also a country which has ratified the European Convention on Human Rights back in 1954. Not just that, Turkey is actually among the handful of countries that drafted the European Convention on Human Rights, not much lesser known fact, and has been in the system from its birth, and has been subject to the jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights since 1990. So this is a long time, right? And yet, you know, state violence continues. The state is still engaged in gross human rights violations with impunity, and human rights lawyers are still under threat. And Turkey's policies, you know, on the Kurdish question basically remain more or less intact, right? So the question is, so there's a puzzle here, right? How is that possible? How is it? And at the same time, the European Court of Human Rights is accepted, widely accepted as the most effective human rights court in the world, right? So if it is the most effective human rights court in the world, how is it that it has failed in this particular country, which has been there from the beginning, as part of the system, at least, you know, had ratified so early on? And then when I looked at, so that was the puzzle. And then I thought, okay, I want to address this question, not just through conventional legal analysis and research, which is, you know, what we call looking at the laws and court decisions, not just that, which is more the top-down perspective, right? What the court has said and what impact it has had. But I want to tell the story, I want to sort of say that at the same time, through the bottom-up analysis of the legal mobilization of Kurdish lawyers, how they mobilized, what they expected, what kind of challenges they face along the way, and what outcomes they received, and what they think about the court, how they perceive the court after all this experience. And that's a sociolegal part of my research. So I brought together sort of conventional doctrinal legal analysis and sociolegal research. So that means I engaged in two roughly scholarships, right? The first is top-down conventional legal analysis. I looked at the scholarship, which is also interdisciplinary, by the way. So it's scholarship by lawyers, political scientists, sociologists on the ECHR, broadly on supranational courts, but particularly on the ECHR. And then there, what you see, and that's the gap that I saw, big gap in a way, that when you look at all these studies, which, you know, depict the ECHR as the most, it's a very effective court, at least until the accession of post-communist, you know, countries and the enlargement and the all kinds of problems that, that enlargement has caused, not least to the docket of the European Court of Human Rights, that until then, at least, it was an effective court. It's just that, you know, it became, you know, the docket, its docket became unmanageable after the enlargement, and things have slowed down, understandably, but with some criticism, etc. So that's the... But what is interesting is that as I read through the scholarship, I saw that Turkey was either not mentioned at all or mentioned literally in a footnote or in a parenthesis. And that, what that really, I mean, Turkey is a country that you cannot footnote, right? I mean, it's one of the seven countries that drafted the convention. It's been there from the, you have to explain this. The failure of the ECHR system has to be explained in the case of Turkey, because for a long time it was the only authoritarian regime that was part of the Council of Europe. Not anymore, of course, after the accession, you had, you know, Russia, and these days arguably increasingly Poland and Hungary. So that was the first gap. The second is when I looked at legal mobilization scholarship, and I have to emphasize, of course, that legal mobilization scholarship is more recent, particularly in the European context. There too, you know, it started really in the US domestic context and then started looking at the European Court of Human Rights and the European Court of Justice. But I also saw that the conclusions, the theoretical conclusions and assumptions of this literature also doesn't sufficiently speak to authoritarian context, because, you know, let's say in the United States, lawyers, public interest lawyers, of course, also face all kinds of challenges in mobilizing the law. But mostly these are challenges such as insufficient resources, funds, etc. Whereas in authoritarian regimes, the challenges are just completely different, right? I mean, often, as in the case of the Kurdish lawyers, they're really legalizing, mobilizing at the cost of their lives or their physical security. So that's the kind of, you know, the gaps that I saw. But in the end, you know, I'm hoping that my book shows is I'm taking the European Court of Human Rights and its engagement in Turkey's Kurdish conflict as a case study to speak about the limitations and possibilities of effective judicial review by supranational courts in authoritarian regimes. So that could be Russia and the ECHR. It could be the Inter-American system. So I'm just hoping that the conclusions I draw and the questions I raise will have broader relevance for scholarship.
Yeah, I really appreciate how when you end this book, it's very much done with an eye towards future research, that this seems like very much like a starting point, a provocation for us to think differently about law and mobilization. And I was also thinking as you were speaking just now, in chapter five, you're mentioning a bit about how legal mobilization depends on the basically effectively the situation, the context in which, you know, human rights violations occur. But what really, really struck me throughout this book, and something that you made quite clear, was that it also is the context that the Kurdish human rights lawyers themselves are operating in, and that there is very much this this political aspect to, you know, the state of Turkey's response to that, which I was surprised, and it was a bit upsetting, I guess. I'm not sure exactly how to put it, but it was, I really also admired the bravery of those who were advocating for these rights. I realized that I might have actually just sort of jumped through something quite quickly, but I was wondering if you could maybe speak for a few minutes about, you know, why Kurdish people did in the first place start bringing these cases to the European Court of Human Rights.
Mm-hmm. May I just interrupt, Ren? Just ask you, am I giving too long answers? I tend to do that.
No, you're perfect. You know? This is fantastic. But It's about you. Okay.
Because I can go on and on, and I don't want to, you know.
Go for it.
Okay. Thank you. So why they litigate? Yes, exactly, right? So why they went to the ECHR. Now, the human right, of course, human rights law, international law, is based still, you know, one of the pillars of international law is state sovereignty, right? And so it is based on the understanding that the principle that states are sovereign, and that when there are disputes between states or between states and individuals, to the extent that states invite supranational courts or international courts, then they seek either mediation from international courts or individuals seek help from them. Ren, actually, let's just skip this whole thing. I'm just starting again. I think it's not necessary, as if I'm lecturing. So the reason was really simple, because throughout, and I should just give a little bit of context for those who may not be familiar with Turkey. The period that I'm, as you said earlier, there is historical, you know, background in the book, but the period that I'm focusing on is 1987 to 2012. And both dates are, of course, significant. In 1987, three things happened in that 1 year. One, Turkey declared a state of emergency in the Kurdish region. I'll get back to that. Secondly, the Turkish government accepted the individual right to petition the European Court of Human Rights, meaning individuals, Turks, citizens in Turkey now had the right to take their claims to the European Court of Human Rights. And third, Turkey made an application for EU membership. The last two are closely interrelated. The reason why Turkey accepted the right of individual petition was because it saw it as, it was completely strategic, right? Because it thought, the Turkish government thought rightfully, that that could have enhanced its chances of getting candidacy status for EU membership, which was true, right? But it's also ironic that that the government gave, in a way, potentially empowered its citizens at the same time as it declared emergency in the Kurdish region. And that's because, and that sort of was the consensus, actually, a government official said at the time, it was clear that the Turkish government, no one in a way expected that this this tool would be utilized, that actually Turks would petition the ECHR, certainly the Kurds, right? And the reason why there was a state of emergency declared is because since 1984, there was a civil war going on between the PKK, Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK is the Kurdish acronym, and the Turkish military in the region. Within the framework of that war, which is a civil war, which the Turkish government has always characterized as, you know, counter-terrorism, that, you know, fight against terrorism, gross violations were committed by the official and unofficial agents of the Turkish government. PKK also engaged in gross violations, but because international human rights law is based on state responsibility, my book is only focused on what the Turkish government's agents have done. And there are four categories: torture, forced displacement coupled with property destruction, enforced disappearances, and extrajudicial executions. So what was going on in this region, which was governed by emergency rule, where government officials, military and civilian officials, were granted with extraordinary powers of, for example, evicting civilians from their homes without giving them accommodation or any assistance, just basically kicking people out of their homes, exiles, I mean, there were just broad powers, media censorship, etc. So during this period, that then enabled emergency rule, then sort of led to these really systematic and gross violations against the entire population in the rural, you know, peasants in the rural centers, who were accused of aiding and abetting the PKK, to middle class, you know, doctors, trade unionists, politicians, activists, human rights lawyers in the urban regions. And then victims started to go to courts. And that's also actually striking, right? Especially when you think that vast majority of the victims were are peasants, you know, many of whom didn't even speak Turkish, illiterate, uneducated, and yet they went to court right away, many of them, right? They would, you know, their son would be disappeared and then they would go to the prosecutor's office. And with a few handful exceptions, the judiciary did not do anything. So this was a situation where state violence was enabled by judicial complicity. Turkish judiciary basically watched, it sort of stood by and watched, right, and enabled this to occur. Either prosecutors would not do any, open any case or conduct any investigations, or sometimes they would, but then they wouldn't issue, you know, sort of, they would just end their investigations, or in rare cases where a case was formally opened up, courts would often issue lack of jurisdiction and just dismiss the case. So, and then, because then, and then, you know, these Kurdish lawyers found out about, they knew about this, you know, decision that the ECHR was available, and they basically said, okay, let's try, let's just go. And at the time, it was very fairly easy to apply to the ECHR. You did not have to speak English. They would just form out forms in Turkish and fax it. That's why. The reason why they applied mainly is because they had absolutely no remedy in Turkish courts. And that's ironic in a way, because international human rights law is based on the principle of state sovereignty. And in the case of the European Court of Human Rights, this translates into this principle of exhaustion of domestic remedies. The understanding is that applicants can only file their petitions with the ECHR, meaning people can only go to the European Court of Human Rights after they demonstrate that they've exhausted all the domestic legal remedies at home. So you first have to go to your own courts, right? And what happened basically is that ECHR, in the end, had to do an had to give an exception. You know, in the famous 1996 Aktvar judgment, Aktvar and others, the court said, basically saw the reality that in the emergency region, there was no, the courts were not hearing these cases. People had no place to turn to, you know, among judicial authorities. So the court said, okay, I'm going to make an exception on a case-by-case basis. Where there are no adequate remedies, then I mean, if the domestic remedies are not adequate or if they are not existing, then this exception doesn't apply. So that's how it started.
Something that that really struck me throughout the book, and I think perhaps some of this too, is I'm also sort of in the socio-legal world as well, and I find questions of evidence and proof really important and sometimes can be quite upsetting. This question of evidence and proving these particular human rights abuses, which you do describe in the book, the torture, you know, forced disappearances, you know, the vignettes of someone being killed and their family members just trying to, you know, one, like bring someone inside so that they don't bleed to death, and then also, you know, be able to bury them. Those very heartbreaking, and I appreciate the way in which you told those stories. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about this question of evidence and proof, because it seems to be a big issue, both in terms of the Kurdish lawyers who are really trying to prove that these, you know, what they describe as happening actually happens, while in the face of, you know, as you describe a few times, of Turkish military or Turkish police, you know, destroying evidence, or, you know, the state just saying, no, like this never happened.
Right. I mean, that's really, I mean, that was at the heart of these, one of the biggest challenges of these cases. You know, I tell the, maybe just a little bit of background in a way, is that, as I said earlier, I started in 1987 and until 2012, and 2012 is the reason, the end date, because that's when Turkey, under EU pressure, granted its citizens the individual right to constitutional complaint. So now individuals in Turkey can go to constitutional court, which then added, of course, yet another layer of domestic remedy to be exhausted. And that sort of changed the story a little bit, not much though. Although in the conclusion chapter, as you know, I bring it to today, you know, post-2012 developments too. But let me close the parentheses and get back to you. The reason why I started answering your question like this is because, you know, because I'm telling the story of a couple of decades of engagement, DCRG's engagement, I try to show how there is no one story, right? There are phases. The ECHR's involvement and oversight has gone through phases, which I broadly, I mean, I, you know, show, you know, three broad phases, but one could, of course, argue that maybe it's more than that. And what determined these phases were sort of the diminishing or increasing engagement of the ECHR were political and legal developments in Turkey, but also in the Council of Europe, you know, the enlargement, the reforms that were made in this European Convention system, or the reforms made in Turkey because of the EU accession process. But there are also, so certain things change, you know, in the story, but there are also certain givens that don't change. The evidence, the European Court of Human Rights' stance on the evidentiary requirements is one of the constants. Even during the, what I call the golden age, in a way, the 90s, the first phase, the period when the European Court of Human Rights was the boldest, the most involved in the Kurdish cases, and did issue precedent-setting judgments. Even then, the court exercised restraint, and I argue that an unjustifiable restraint. And evidence was one of the main issues. So the ECHR, on the, I mean, I keep saying ECHR, I hope it's clear to the audience by now that it's the European Court of Human Rights. The European Court of Human Rights imposes an evidentiary burden called beyond reasonable doubt. So applicants are required to demonstrate their claims beyond reasonable doubt, right? That an average uninformed individual should not have, you know, shouldn't have sort of, it should be clear to an average person that the applicant has actually demonstrated, supported his claims or her claims. Problem is, and this was actually an objection that was made to the court also internally by some of the judges. For example, Judge Bonello at the time, right? So there were dissenters. There was not a uniformity. There was a clear majority, obviously. But there were a few judges that from the beginning had an issue with this. And what they were saying was, you know, we're not a criminal court. This is an evidentiary standard that is imposed on, you know, in criminal trials, on prosecutors. Because, of course, at the end, what is at stake is an individual's life and physical security, right? I mean, you may end up in jail. So the state had, the prosecutors have burden to prove their, accusations beyond reasonable doubt. Whereas this is a human rights court, we're establishing state responsibility, which will lead in, you know, if the state loses, compensation, or maybe some, you know, general reform requirements. This is just an extremely high burden of proof, particularly in cases like this, which, as you mentioned, let's take enforced disappearance, right? So what was happening? This was, what was happening in the Kurdish region for those of, you know, those listeners who may be more familiar, for example, what was happening in Central America, you know, in the 70s, for example, in Honduras and stuff. It was pretty much the same thing, right? So individuals would be just picked up from, you know, people walking on the street, daylight, broad daylight, would be picked up by some civilian dressed men in, you know, who were driving cars, often without a license number, white Renaults they were. They would just put, you know, dragged into a car and then disappeared. And that was it. And in many cases, they would be disappeared for good. There would be nobody found. If the families were lucky, the case would result in extrajudicial execution, meaning executed body would be found somewhere a couple of days later or in a grave months or years later. So the victims' families would go to, of course, authorities right away, as I said. You know, they go to police, to prosecutors. And in all cases, the authorities would deny that the individual was in their custody. So these are cases where there was complete government denial, right? And also before the European Court of Human Rights. So where the case would reach Strasbourg, Turkish government's defense was always the same. Oh, we didn't do it, right? We didn't detain this person, also in torture cases, right? Either we didn't detain it or we didn't do it. And oftentimes blaming on the PKK without absolutely no ground, although there was no investigation made, right? And so in this circumstance, then, and there's nobody, right? So the government claims that the person, denies that the person was detained or disappeared or, you know, killed. The ECHR was expecting applicants to prove beyond reasonable doubt that the government was responsible for the abduction of this person, for the disappearance of, it's just impossible. How can you? Because how can you prove that, right? I mean, there's no custody record. So that really, that is one of the fundamental problems with the CHR's jurisprudence, that they just did not do that. And that's one difference, by the way, with the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, which, you know, we can talk about later. I'm saying this because, you know, I also don't want listeners to think that, oh, maybe that's what supranational human rights courts do. Maybe that's what it was, that the court's hands were tied. They weren't. You know, the court could have been much more flexible on evidentiary issues and, of course, on other issues too.
I appreciate you highlighting the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, because I do have a question for you about that in a minute. But I also realized that I've been asking questions sort of around a fairly major political issue, political context that you do highlight in the book, which is Turkey seeking to join the EU. And I was hoping that you could talk a little bit more about sort of how that process actually informed, you know, a lot of the context for what you're describing. I was just really struck by, again, you know, realizing that questions of access to justice, access to legal recourse, that sort of thing can also be very much influenced by these sort of big international political processes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, going back to the Latin American case, and this is not novel to Turkey. You know, when you look at, for example, Argentina, how the military dictatorship there ended, that was largely due, of course, there was resistance domestically, but largely due to the pressure of external governments, first and foremost, of course, the United States. You know, there was a lot of diplomatic pressure. I mean, certainly the military defeat that they had in the Falklands also helped. I mean, I don't want to deviate here, but the point I'm trying to make is that authoritarian regimes, such as Turkey, where in authoritarian regimes where the state is very strong and civil society is very weak, although we have a vibrant civil society in Turkey, but it's very weak, and where state violence is rampant, where there's a historical legacy. I should also mention that it didn't start with the Kurdish conflict. You know, you can go back to the 1915 Armenian genocide, yet another, you know, a case of total impunity. But anyway, so in these contexts, external pressure and where when you're talking about countries which are economically not independent and which are dependent on, you know, foreign financial assistance or international trade or et cetera, like Turkey, right? So it's not a rich country. It doesn't have its own resources. It's really completely dependent on, especially the EU, financially. There, external actors have a very important role to play. Political pressure, diplomatic pressure, do not necessarily end human rights violations, do not necessarily lead to complete regime change. I mean, when I say regime change, I'm talking about legal regime. But they do make a difference. Now, in the case of Turkey, the reason there was this phase that I talked earlier when I was back in Turkey and engaged in this democratization program, you know, the process, is that was the phase where the EU, that was made possible by the EU's decision in 1999 to give Turkey candidate status, and then in 2004, end of 2004, to start accession negotiations. But especially the first one, because once you have candidate status, that then means that European Commission starts to monitor. There are these criteria that candidate countries have to abide by, including human rights, rule of law, etc. And then you're monitored, right? And then the EU looks and they issue progress reports annually and say, okay, you've done this and this, but you still have to do this and this. And that's where the ECHR came into picture, because the European Union, not just in Turkey, but in all candidate countries and later in accession countries, considered European Court of Human Rights' judgments as benchmarks in measuring progress, right? For example, you know, it would say, okay, the European Court of Human Rights found this case where violation in, for example, the presence of military judge in state security courts, you have to then remove these judges, right? You have to. And then the Turkish government started doing them. So there was a phase where there was really an opportunity. There was a window of opportunity for change. but more importantly, for the empowerment of civil rights movement in Turkey. For me, that's the most important part of it. Because we know that so many of the reforms that were done, I mean, some were real, but many were cosmetic, and then many were rolled back. But what the EU really did, and I saw this firsthand because I was part of it, that whole process, is that it really opened up this process of, it opened up space for democratic dialogue, for, and you see, we saw mushrooming of NGOs, et cetera. And it really empowered human rights, you know, the human rights movement. So whatever change has happened was not the direct result of ECHR judgments, but it was because EU made ECHR judgments, used ECHR judgments as benchmark to, you know, to measure progress. And then the European Union, you know, made two mistakes, in my opinion. One, the first, is that they gave accession status prematurely. That was too early, that decision. You know, Erdogan had just came to power, and he and his government were appeared serious and determined, and they wanted quick result. And the European Union, in order to support Erdogan against the military, which was very powerful in Turkey, made an exception for the first time in history. No other candidate country had such favorable treatment. The EU basically started to start accession process, although Turkey had not yet fully complied with fulfilled Copenhagen, the accession criteria. The language was that Turkey sufficiently fulfilled accession criteria, which I think was too, it was, that was not right, because then that lifted the pressure, reform pressure. But then the second mistake that they made is that soon after, due to domestic developments in France, Germany, Merkel and Sarkozy coming to power, EU effectively ended, not formally, ended the accession process very soon after it started. And that was also not right because, you know, Turkey was making progress. Also, Cyprus had joined in the unanimity. Cyprus started to block decision-making in the EU because of the Cyprus problem, etc. Things got really complicated. But going back to my, you know, our conversation and the, you know, my book and what that matters is that then you see how that affected the reforms that were carried out in Turkey and Turkey's relation with the European Court of Human Rights, because then Turkey gradually started to sort of, you know, not care so much about the ECHR. So it's never just about, of course, it's never just about law, no? It's law and politics.
I just, in listening to you now, and then also, again, sort of reflecting on my thoughts while reading this book, a very clear thread that goes through all of this is the question of effectiveness. So like what makes a court effective, you know, is the European Court of Human Rights sort of effective in particular ways? And something that you've mentioned in our conversation and that also comes through in the book is the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. And I was hoping you could talk maybe a little about how you see this book, you know, as sort of opening up a question, or as, you know, looking to other places like the Inter-American Court of Human Rights to get at this broader question of effectiveness. And this I think is this question of effectiveness. I was really struck by because it feels so desperately important, because as you really lay out, you know, we're talking about really serious human rights abuses. And so this question of, you know, how to make courts more effective, or sort of how to have different responses to human rights abuses. It's really, really pressing.
Absolutely. And more so, no? I mean, now since the publication of, since I finished writing this book, you know, even more so now, you know, there's this whole, you know, with discussions on Poland and Hungary in Europe, etc. Certainly. No, I mean, let's start with human rights court. So what is the function of the European Court of Human Rights? I mean, I think that's the primary, one of the primary fundamental questions that we need to raise when we discuss and talk about these courts. What is its function, and in whose eyes should it seek its legitimacy? One problem that I see when I, you know, follow the discussions, debates on the ECHR, and also, you know, sort of hear ECHR officials and judges speak, is that I think they've kind of, many of them at many times, they lose track of who they are supposed to protect and serve. I would think and I think I'm right, that their primary stakeholders are us, individuals, people. I mean, especially, of course, human rights victims or potential human rights victims, right? Who, because a human rights victim in these cases are, you know, our human rights are violated by our own governments, right? And especially in situations like Turkey, where you're talking about gross human rights violations, torture, extrajudicial execution by state agents, and where there's judicial complicity, then there is an indispensable role for supranational courts to play, precisely because there's no other place to turn for these individuals, right? Because the fund, I mean, human rights, of course, human rights law have made many promises, increasing promises, right? But I think the fundamental promise, we may argue, is the promise given to us that, you know, we will be protected from torture or being murdered. I mean, that's, I think, and when you look at right to life and free from torture, these are unconditional. I mean, it's particularly, you know, torture, but, you know, there is no if and but. It's not like freedom of expression. And I think that my book is not a comparative study on inter-American and European systems. That's what I'm doing now, actually. We may talk about it later if there's time. But the reason, I just basically in my conclusion, I kind of draw upon the Inter-American Court to highlight this. Because what the Inter-American Court did in its first judgment, by the way, very first judgment in 1989, is Velazquez-Rodriguez versus Honduras, enforced disappearance case. Same story, pretty much, no? I mean, again, you know, the victim was disappeared, government denies, family is desperate, every authority that they turn to, domestic level, turns them down, etc., and then they finally go to the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. Again, there's no evidence, no? So what the court does there, the Inter-American Court, kind of takes a step back and looks at the big picture. And the court says, okay, this is an enforced disappearance case. The regime is, you know, I mean, it's a brutal regime, basically. They're denying it. So what I'm going to do is that I'm going to be flexible in dealing with this case. On evidence issues, for example, what the court does there is it accepts circumstantial evidence because there is no direct evidence. And the court says, okay, just bring me whatever you can. So witness testimonies, media reports, reports of international human rights organizations. And then the court looks at the totality of this and says, it's not just Mr. Velazquez-Rodriguez, there were others. And then the court says, well, there's a pattern here. You know, the families pretty much say the same story. You know, the kind of vehicles, the way it's done, the denial, etc. And then you have these reports backing them up by also international organizations. And the Inter-American Court says, there's a state policy here. Based on one case alone, because it accepts circumstantial evidence, it says that Honduras was engaged in a policy, state practice of enforced disappearances against hundreds of people. The European Court of Human Rights, after dozens and dozens of judgments, very similar judgments, to this day has never said that Turkey engaged in a policy of torture, that Turkey engaged in enforced disappearances, although non-judicial bodies of the United Nations, but also of the Council of Europe, of which the ECHR is a part of. And I'm here talking about the European Committee, for example, for the Prevention of Torture, UN's various special representatives, rapporteurs, etc., who base their reports on fact findings that they've done in Turkey, unlike in Strasbourg. I mean, Strasbourg in some cases did fact-finding hearings, but these people, these rapporteurs, committee members, they actually went to Turkey, they went to detention centers, they did interview victims and families and doctors and lawyers and government officials, and based on that comprehensive report, concluded that torture was systematic in Turkey, that there were enforced disappearances. And the ECHR did not take these into consideration as evidence. I mean, that begs explanation. And we have to, you know, hold the ECHR accountable for that. So going back to effectiveness, I think what I'm proposing, humbly proposing in the book, is that we really need to rethink effectiveness when it comes to authoritarian regimes. Everything that I'm saying concerns authoritarian regimes, not liberal democracies where, with all their imperfections, there are courts functioning, people have access to, you know, judicial review, etc. In these contexts, authoritarian regimes engage in state violence, there is judicial complicity, and against minorities. Of course, we didn't talk about that, but the fact that Kurds are minority is important because minorities, by definition, are minority, also power, you know, in terms of political power, they just don't have the means to influence policies, etc., is that we need to think about effectiveness in a different way. And I propose that a supranational court is effective if it does two things. And that comes back to the top-down and bottom-up dimensions I talked earlier. The first is, it's a court that is, effectiveness cannot be a matter of compliance, because as I said, authoritarian regimes rarely comply. Even if they adopt some reforms, they're cosmetic, they roll these, you know, reforms back, etc. Courts are effective if they are exhausting all of their powers. If what I'm saying, you know, in daily words, in a way, if they're doing their best. You know, if they're exhausting all of their jurisprudential tools and resources, right? Holding fact-finding hearings, being flexible on evidentiary issues, narrowing margin of appreciation that they grant to governments, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a whole list there. So that's one. And the second is, that's the bottom-up, is that they are effective, I think, if they are open to the legal mobilization of minorities. You know, they have to remain open. Whereas the ECHR, and this is a trend that has gone, it's become all the more clear in recent years in Turkey after the failed coup, is that the ECHR has become a very, very, very inaccessible court for victims. It assumes the effectiveness of domestic remedies in Turkey. It rejects cases because individuals, applicants, did not go to the constitutional court or went to constitutional court but did not wait for the result of their complaints. And I mean, the fundamental problem there is, I think, that the ECHR has been and remains in denial of this basic fact that Turkey is not a democratic regime. So in a democratic regime, you cannot apply subsidiarity principle, this principle of, that supranational court supervision is subsidiary to those of domestic courts, that we should first, you know, this domestic, you know, the question that individuals have to exhaust domestic remedies. All of the, what I'm saying in the end is that when it comes to authoritarian, what I'm proposing is this: courts have to have differentiated jurisprudence. They have to make a difference between, differentiate between authoritarian regimes and liberal democracies. And that's across the board in their procedural rules, in their substantive doctrine, in, you know, inadmissibility decisions, friendly settlements. We didn't even talk about that. But, you know, you cannot treat a liberal democracy and an authoritarian regime the same way. And they have to be much more stringent, much more activist in their oversight when it comes to, you know, the cases that I'm, that my book is about. So that in a nutshell is, and the Inter-American court seems to be, I mean, of course there are, I know, kind of objections that can be made. Its docket cannot even be compared to the European Court of Human Rights. The European Court of Human Rights is just basically overwhelmed. It's paralyzed. That's true. The Inter-American Court of Human Rights has to deal with a much smaller docket. But I think it's interesting is that we don't, first of all, there's not much comparative work on these two courts, although it's, you know, there is an emerging, jurisprudence, scholarship. But it's interesting also is that, you know, and I heard this from scholars of the Inter-American system, they also kind of complain that, you know, European scholars of the European system kind of assume that the better one is the European one. So the Inter-American one has to learn from the European one. I think when it comes to authoritarian regimes, especially, it's the other way around. I mean, there is, because of the political history, of course, of the Americas, you know, military dictatorships, etc., the way that the Inter-American regime in general, not just the court, but also the commission, we have to emphasize the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which still exists. It's a two-tier system, unlike the European one, is that they have a very valuable experience. I mean, really, in terms of dealing with these issues of transition, transitional justice, reparations, how to, what kind of remedies to give in to victims of gross human rights violations, et cetera, that the European court has to learn from. The problem is that the European court now is just so preoccupied, especially under its current president, with the backlog, and it's, you know, they're acting with self-interest, the self-interest to basically get rid of as many cases as possible. I gave a very long answer again, Ren.
No, that's a fantastic answer. That's a really great answer, in part because it helps us sort of transition where we've taken up a lot of your time today, and I could definitely talk about this book for hours, but I won't ask you to do that, of course. And you hinted at a current project that you're working on right now, so I was hoping in the last few minutes, if you wouldn't mind sort of letting us know what you're working on now.
Well, I mean, it's a comparative project on the two systems, the Inter-American and the European Court of Human Rights. It's, of course, going to be law. I mean, I'm here for a year. It also, my ability to do the project depends on my ability to raise funds, unfortunately, for this. But what I want to do is to seek answers to the question that I raise at the end of my, in my book, is that, is there something inherent to supranational judicial oversight? Ineffectiveness, ECHR's failure in Turkey, to what extent was that inherent to the constraints of supranational oversight? Because obviously there are constraints. But to what extent it was because of the European Court of Human Rights' unwillingness to exhaust its powers, to make full use of its powers. And I'm looking at the Inter-American system and the European system in terms of their dealings with oversights of authoritarian regimes again. So it's comparative, and I'm looking at issues such as oversight of emergency powers, special criminal courts, evidentiary issues, etc., to see how the two systems have dealt with that, and whether there is, what they can learn from each other. And this time I'm aiming to put forth a theory of effectiveness of supranational courts, if I can. We'll see.
That sounds fantastic. Dilek, thank you so much for being on the show today. And have a great rest of your day. Take care.
Thank you very much for having me.